That's all there is to it, the fattish Dr. Blodgett announced through the microphone in the ingratiating sales tone of a department store floorwalker. There is no nail or rivet remaining in the frame of the structures, and there is no blood vessel left unbroken in the bodies of the animals. The crowd was rustling with jerky movements and high-pitched whispers. People were looking at one another, rising uncertainly and dropping down again, restlessly demanding anything but this pause. There was a sound of submerged hysteria in the whispers. They seemed to be waiting to be told what to think. Dr. Stadler saw a woman being escorted down the steps from the back row, her head bent, a handkerchief pressed to her mouth. She was sick at her stomach. He turned away and saw that Dr. Ferris was still watching him. Dr. Stadler leaned back a little, his face austere and scornful, the face of the nation's greatest scientist, and asked, "Who invented that ghastly thing?"
"You did."
Dr. Stadler looked at him, not moving.
"It is merely a practical appliance," said Dr. Ferris pleasantly. "Based upon your theoretical discoveries, it was derived from your invaluable research into the nature of cosmic rays and of the spatial transmission of energy."
"Who worked on the project?"
"A few third-raters, as you would call them. Really, there was very little difficulty. None of them could have begun to conceive of the first step toward the concept of your energy transmission formula, but given that, the rest was easy."
"What is the practical purpose of this invention? What are the epoch-making possibilities?"
"Oh, but don't you see? It is an invaluable instrument of public security. No enemy would attack the possessor of such a weapon. It will set the country free from the fear of aggression and permit it to plan its future in undisturbed safety."
His voice had an odd carelessness, a tone of offhand improvisation, as if he were neither expecting nor attempting to be believed.
"It will relieve social frictions. It will promote peace, stability, and, as we have indicated, harmony. It will eliminate all danger of war."
"What war? What aggression? With the whole world starving and all those people's states barely subsisting on handouts from this country, where do you see any danger of war? Do you expect those ragged savages to attack you?"
Dr. Ferris looked straight into his eyes. "Internal enemies can be as great a danger to the people as external ones," he answered.
"Perhaps greater." This time his voice sounded as if he expected and was certain to be understood.
"Social systems are so precarious. But think of what stability could be achieved by a few scientific installations at strategic key points. It would guarantee a state of permanent peace, don't you think so?"
Dr. Stadler did not move or answer. As the seconds clicked past and his face still held an unchanged expression, it began to look paralyzed. His eyes had the stare of a man who suddenly sees that which he had known from the first, had spent years trying not to see, and who is now engaged in a contest between the sight and his power to deny its existence. "I don't know what you're talking about," he snapped at last. Dr. Ferris smiled.
"No private businessman or greedy industrialist would have financed Project X," he said softly, in the tone of an idle, informal discussion. "He couldn't have afforded it. It's an enormous investment, with no prospect of material gain. What profit could he expect from it? There are no profits henceforth to be derived from that farm."
He pointed at the dark strip in the distance.
"But, as you have so well observed, Project X had to be a non-profit venture. Contrary to a business firm, the State Science Institute had no trouble in obtaining funds for the project. You have not heard of the Institute having any financial difficulties in the past 2 years, have you? And it used to be such a problem, getting them to vote the funds necessary for the advancement of science. They always demanded gadgets for their cash, as you used to say. Well, here was a gadget which some people in power could fully appreciate. They got the others to vote for it. It wasn't difficult. In fact, a great many of those others felt safe in voting money for a project that was secret. They felt certain it was important, since they were not considered important enough to be let in on it. There were, of course, a few skeptics and doubters, but they gave in when they were reminded that the head of the State Science Institute was Dr. Robert Stadler, whose judgment and integrity they could not doubt."
Dr. Stadler was looking down at his fingernails. The sudden screech of the microphone jerked the crowd into an instantaneous attentiveness. People seemed to be a second's worth of self-control away from panic. An announcer with a voice like a machine gun, spitting smiles, barked cheerily that they were now to witness the radio broadcast that would break the news of the great discovery to the whole nation. Then, with a glance at his watch, his script, and the signaling arm of Wesley Mooch, he yelled into the sparkling snake head of the microphone, into the living rooms, the offices, the studies, the nurseries of the country. "Ladies and gentlemen, Project X." Dr. Ferris leaned toward Dr. Stadler, through the staccato hoofbeats of the announcer's voice galloping across the continent with a description of the new invention, and said in the tone of a casual remark, "It is vitally important that there be no criticism of the project in the country at this precarious time." Then added semi-accidentally, as a semi-joke, "That there be no criticism of anything at any time." "And the nation's political, cultural, intellectual, and moral leaders," the announcer was yelling into the microphone, "who have witnessed this great event as your representatives and in your name, will now tell you their views of it in person." Mr. Thompson was the first to mount the wooden steps to the platform of the microphone. He snapped his way through a brief speech, hailing a new era and declaring, in the belligerent tone of a challenge to unidentified enemies, that science belonged to the people, and that every man on the face of the globe had a right to a share of the advantages created by technological progress. Wesley Mooch came next. He spoke about social planning and the necessity of unanimous rallying in support of the planners. He spoke about discipline, unity, austerity, and the patriotic duty of bearing temporary hardships. "We have mobilized the best brains of the country to work for your welfare. This great invention was the product of the genius of a man whose devotion to the cause of humanity is not to be questioned, a man acknowledged by all as the greatest mind of the century, Dr. Robert Stadler." "What?" gasped Dr. Stadler, whirling toward Ferris. Dr. Ferris looked at him with a glance of patient mildness. "He didn't ask my permission to say that," Dr. Stadler half snapped, half whispered. Dr. Ferris spread out his hands in a gesture of reproachful helplessness. "Now you see, Dr. Stadler, how unfortunate it is if you allow yourself to be disturbed by political matters which you have always considered unworthy of your attention and knowledge. You see, it is not Mr. Mooch's function to ask permissions." The figure now slouching against the sky on the speaker's platform, coiling itself about the microphone, talking in the bored, contemptuous tone of an off-color story, was Dr. Simon Pritchett. He was declaring that the new invention was an instrument of social welfare, which guaranteed general prosperity, and that anyone who doubted this self-evident fact was an enemy of society to be treated accordingly. "This invention, the product of Dr. Robert Stadler, the preeminent lover of freedom..." Dr. Ferris opened a briefcase, produced some pages of neatly typed copy, and turned to Dr. Stadler.
"You are to be the climax of the broadcast," he said. "You will speak last at the end of the hour." He extended the pages. "Here's the speech you'll make."
His eyes said the rest. They said that his choice of words had not been accidental. Dr. Stadler took the pages, but held them between the tips of two straight fingers, as one might hold a scrap of waste paper about to be tossed aside. "I haven't asked you to appoint yourself as my ghostwriter," he said. The sarcasm of the voice gave Ferris his clue. This was not a moment for sarcasm.
"I couldn't have allowed your invaluable time to be taken up by the writing of radio speeches," said Dr. Ferris. "I felt certain that you would appreciate it."
He said it in a tone of spurious politeness, intended to be recognized as spurious, the tone of tossing to a beggar the alms of face-saving. Dr. Stadler's answer disturbed him.
Dr. Stadler did not choose to answer, or to glance down at the manuscript. "Lack of faith," a beefy speaker was snarling on the platform in the tone of a street brawl. "Lack of faith is the only thing we got to fear. If we have faith in the plans of our leaders, why, the plans will work, and we'll all have prosperity and ease and plenty. It's the fellows who go around doubting and destroying our morale. It's they're who keeping us in shortages and misery. But we're not going to let them do it much longer. We're here to protect the people. And if any of those doubting smarties come around, believe you me, we'll take care of them." "It would be unfortunate," said Dr. Ferris in a soft voice, "to arouse popular resentment against the State Science Institute at an explosive time like the present. There's a great deal of dissatisfaction and unrest in the country, and if people should misunderstand the nature of the new invention, they're liable to vent their rage on all scientists. Scientists have never been popular with the masses. Peace, a tall, willowy woman was sighing into the microphone. This invention is a great new instrument of peace. It will protect us from the aggressive designs of selfish enemies. It will allow us to breathe freely and to learn to love our fellow men. She had a bony face with a mouth embittered at cocktail parties and wore a flowing pale blue gown, suggesting the concert garment of a harpist. It may well be considered as that miracle which was thought impossible in history, the dream of the ages, the final synthesis of science and love. Dr. Stadler looked at the faces in the grandstands. They were sitting quietly now, they were listening, but their eyes had an ebbing look of twilight, a look of fear in the process of being accepted as permanent, the look of raw wounds being dimmed by the veil of infection. They knew as he knew it, that they were the targets of the shapeless funnels protruding from the mushroom building's dome. And he wondered in what manner they were now extinguishing their minds and escaping that knowledge. He knew that the words they were eager to absorb and believe were the chains slipping in to hold them like the goats, securely within the range of those funnels. They were eager to believe. He saw the tightening lines of their lips. He saw the occasional glances of suspicion they threw at their neighbors, as if the horror that threatened them was not the sound ray, but the men who would make them acknowledge it as horror. Their eyes were veiling over, but the remnant look of a wound was a cry for help. "What do you think they think?" said Dr. Ferris softly. "Reason is the scientist's only weapon, and reason has no power over men, has it? At a time like ours, with the country falling apart, with the mob driven by blind desperation to the edge of open riots and violence, order must be maintained by any means available. What can we do when we have to deal with people?" Dr. Stadler did not answer. A fat, jellied woman with an inadequate brassiere under a dark, perspiration-stained dress was saying into the microphone, Dr. Stadler could not believe it at first, that the new invention was to be greeted with particular gratitude by the mothers of the country. Dr. Stadler turned away. Watching him, Ferris could see nothing but the noble line of the high forehead and the deep cut of bitterness at the corner of the mouth. Suddenly, without context or warning, Robert Stadler whirled to face him. It was like a spurt of blood from a sudden crack in a wound that had almost closed. Stadler's face was open. Open in pain, in horror, in sincerity. As if for that moment both he and Ferris were human beings, while he moaned with incredulous despair. "In a civilized century, Ferris. In a civilized century." Dr. Ferris took his time to produce and prolong a soft chuckle. "I don't know what you're talking about," he answered in the tone of a quotation. Dr. Stadler lowered his eyes. When Ferris spoke again, his voice had the faintest edge of a tone which Stadler could not define, except that it did not belong in any civilized discussion. "It would be unfortunate if anything were to happen to jeopardize the State Science Institute. It would be most unfortunate if the Institute were to be closed, or if any one of us were to be forced to leave it. Where would we go? Scientists are an inordinate luxury these days, and there aren't many people or establishments left who are able to afford necessities, let alone luxuries. There are no doors left open to us. We wouldn't be welcome in the research department of an industrial concern such as, let us say, Reardon Steel. Besides, if we should happen to make enemies, the same enemies would be feared by any person tempted to employ our talents. A man like Reardon would have fought for us. Would a man like Orrin Boyle? But this is purely theoretical speculation because, as a matter of practical fact, all private establishments of scientific research have been closed by law, by Directive 10-289, issued, as you might not realize, by Mr. Wesley Mooch. Are you thinking, perhaps, of universities? They are in the same position. They can't afford to make enemies. Who would speak up for us? I believe that some such man as Hugh Axton would have come to our defense. But to think of that is to be guilty of an anachronism. He belonged to a different age. The conditions set up in our social and economic reality have long since made his continued existence impossible. and I don't think that Dr. Simon Pritchett, or the generation reared under his guidance, would be able or willing to defend us. I have never believed in the efficacy of idealists. Have you? And this is no age for impractical idealism. If anyone wished to oppose a government policy, how would he make himself heard? Through these gentlemen of the press, Dr. Stadler? Through this microphone? Is there an independent newspaper left in the country, an uncontrolled radio station, a private piece of property for that matter, or a personal opinion? The tone of the voice was obvious now. It was the tone of a thug. A personal opinion is the one luxury that nobody can afford today. Dr. Stadler's lips moved stiffly as the muscles of the goats. You are speaking to Robert Stadler. I have not forgotten that. It is precisely because I have not forgotten it that I am speaking. Robert Stadler is an illustrious name, which I would hate to see destroyed. But what is an illustrious name nowadays? In whose eyes? His arms swept over the grandstands. In the eyes of people such as you see around you. If they will believe when so told that an instrument of death is a tool of prosperity, would they not believe it if they were told that Robert Stadler is a traitor and an enemy of the state? Would you then rely on the fact that this is not true? Are you thinking of truth, Dr. Stadler? Questions of truth do not enter into social issues. Principles have no influence on public affairs. Reason has no power over human beings. Logic is impotent. Morality is superfluous. Do not answer me now, Dr. Stadler. You will answer me over the microphone. You're the next speaker. Looking off at the dark strip of the farm in the distance, Dr. Stadler knew that what he felt was terror, but he would not permit himself to know its nature. He who had been able to study the particles and subparticles of cosmic space would not permit himself to examine his feeling and to know that it was made of three parts. One part was terror of a vision that seemed to stand before his eyes, the vision of the inscription cut in his honor over the door of the Institute. To the fearless mind, to the inviolate truth. Another part was plain, brute, animal fear of physical destruction, a humiliating fear, which in the civilized world of his youth he had not expected ever to experience. And the third was the terror of the knowledge that by betraying the first, one delivers oneself into the realm of the second. He walked toward the speaker's scaffold, his steps firm and slow, his head lifted. The manuscript of the speech held crumpled in his fingers. It looked like a walk to mount either a pedestal or a guillotine. As the whole of a man's life flashes before him in his dying moment, so he walked to the sound of the announcer's voice reading to the country the list of Robert Stadler's achievements and career. A faint convulsion ran over Robert Stadler's face at the words, "Former head of the Department of Physics of the Patrick Henry University." He knew distantly, as if the knowledge were within him, but as if it were within some person he was leaving behind, that the crowd was about to witness an act of destruction more terrible than the destruction of the farm. He had mounted the first three steps of the scaffold, when a young newsman tore forward, ran to him, and from below, seized the railing to stop him. "Dr. Stadler," he cried in a desperate whisper, "tell them the truth. Tell them that you had nothing to do with it. Tell them what sort of infernal machine it is and for what purpose it's intended to be used. Tell the country what sort of people are trying to rule it. Nobody can doubt your word. Tell them the truth. Save us. You're the only one who can." Dr. Stadler looked down at him. He was young. His movements and voice had that swift, sharp clarity which belongs to competence. Among his aged, corrupt, favor-ridden, and pull-created colleagues, he had managed to achieve the rank of elite of the political press, by means, and in the role of, a last, irresistible spark of ability. His eyes had the look of an eager, unfrightened intelligence. They were the kind of eyes Dr. Stadler had seen looking up at him from the benches of classrooms. He noticed that this boy's eyes were hazel. They had a tinge of green. Dr. Stadler turned his head and saw that Ferris had come rushing to his side like a servant or a jailer. "I do not expect to be insulted by disloyal young punks with treasonable motives," said Dr. Stadler loudly. Dr. Ferris whirled upon the young man and snapped, his face out of control, distorted by rage at the unexpected and unplanned.
Give me your press card and your work permit.
I am proud, Dr. Robert Stadler read into the microphone and into the attentive silence of a nation, that my years of work in the service of science have brought me the honor of placing into the hands of our great leader, Mr. Thompson, a new instrument with an incalculable potential for a civilizing and liberating influence upon the mind of man. The sky had the stagnant breath of a furnace, and the streets of New York were like pipes running not with air and light, but with melted dust. Dagny stood on a street corner where the airport bus had left her, looking at the city in passive astonishment. The buildings seemed worn by weeks of summer heat, but the people seemed worn by centuries of anguish. She stood watching them, disarmed by an enormous sense of unreality. That sense of unreality had been her only feeling since the early hours of the morning, since the moment when, at the end of an empty highway, she had walked into an unknown town and stopped the first passer-by to ask where she was.
Watsonville, he answered.
What state, please? She asked. The man glanced at her, said,
Nebraska,
and walked hastily away. She smiled mirthlessly, knowing that he wondered where she had come from, and that no explanation he could imagine would be as fantastic as the truth. Yet it was Watsonville that seemed fantastic to her, as she walked through its streets to the railroad station. She had lost the habit of observing despair as the normal and dominant aspect of human existence, so normal as to become unnoticed, and the sight of it struck her in all of its senseless futility. She was seeing the brand of pain and fear on the faces of people, and the look of evasion that refuses to know it. They seemed to be going through the motions of some enormous pretense, acting out a ritual to ward off reality, letting the earth remain unseen and their lives unlived, in dread of something namelessly forbidden. Yet the forbidden was the simple act of looking at the nature of their pain and questioning their duty to bear it. She was seeing it so clearly that she kept wanting to approach strangers, to shake them, to laugh in their faces and to cry, "Snap out of it!" There was no reason for people to be as unhappy as that, she thought, no reason whatever. And then she remembered that reason was the one power they had banished from their existence. She boarded a Taggart train for the nearest airfield. She did not identify herself to anyone. It seemed irrelevant. She sat at the window of a coach like a stranger who has to learn the incomprehensible language of those around her. She picked up a discarded newspaper. She managed, with effort, to understand what was written, but not why it should ever have been written. It all seemed so childishly senseless. She stared in astonishment at a paragraph in a syndicated column from New York which stated overemphatically that Mr. James Taggart wished it to be known that his sister had died in an airplane crash, any unpatriotic rumors to the contrary notwithstanding. Slowly, she remembered Directive 10-289 and realized that Jim was embarrassed by the public suspicion that she had vanished as a deserter. The wording of the paragraph suggested that her disappearance had been a prominent public issue, not yet dropped. There were other suggestions of it, a mention of Miss Taggart's tragic death in a story about the growing number of plane crashes, and on the back page an ad offering a $100,000 reward to the person who would find the wreckage of her plane, signed by Henry Reardon. The last gave her a stab of urgency. The rest seemed meaningless. Then slowly she realized that her return was a public event which would be taken as big news. She felt a lethargic weariness at the prospect of a dramatic homecoming, of facing Jim and the press, of witnessing the excitement. She wished they would get it over with in her absence. At the airfield, she saw a small-town reporter interviewing some departing officials. She waited till he had finished, then she approached him, extended her credentials, and said quietly to the gaping stare of his eyes, "I'm Dagny Taggart. Would you make it known, please, that I'm alive and that I'll be in New York this afternoon?" The plane was about to take off, and she escaped the necessity of answering questions. She watched the prairies, the rivers, the towns, slipping past at an untouchable distance below. And she noted that the sense of detachment one feels when looking at the earth from a plane was the same sense she felt when looking at people. Only her distance from people seemed longer. The passengers were listening to some radio broadcast, which appeared to be important, judging by their earnest attentiveness. She caught brief snatches of fraudulent voices talking about some sort of new invention that was to bring some undefined benefits to some undefined public's welfare. The words were obviously chosen to convey no specific meaning whatever. She wondered how one could pretend that one was hearing a speech. Yet that was what the passengers were doing. They were going through the performance of a child, who, not yet able to read, holds a book open and spells out anything he wishes to spell, pretending that it is contained in the incomprehensible black lines. But the child, she thought, knows that he is playing a game. These people pretend to themselves that they are not pretending. They know no other state of existence. The sense of unreality remained as her only feeling when she landed, when she escaped a crowd of reporters without being seen, by avoiding the taxi stands and leaping into the airport bus, when she rode on the bus, then stood on a street corner looking at New York. She felt as if she were seeing an abandoned city. She felt no sense of homecoming when she entered her apartment. The place seemed to be a convenient machine that she could use for some purpose of no significance whatever. But she felt a quickened touch of energy, like the first break in a fog, a touch of meaning, when she picked up the telephone receiver and called Reardon's office in Pennsylvania.
"Oh, Miss Taggart! Miss Taggart!"
said, in a joyous moan, the voice of the severe, unemotional Miss Ives. "Hello, Miss Ives. I haven't startled you, have I? You knew that I was alive?"
"Oh, yes, I heard it on the radio this morning."
"Is Mr. Reardon in his office?"
"No, Miss Taggart. He's in the Rocky Mountains, searching for... That is..."
"Yes, I know. Do you know where we can reach him?"
"I expect to hear from him at any moment. He's stopping in Los Gatos, Colorado, right now. I phoned him the moment I heard the news, but he was out, and I left a message for him to call me. You see, he's out flying most of the day. But he'll call me when he comes back to the hotel."
"What hotel is it?"
"The El Dorado Hotel in Los Gatos."
"Thank you, Miss Ives." She was about to hang up.
"Oh, Miss Taggart?"
"Yes."
"What was it that happened to you? Where were you?"
I'll tell you when I see you. I'm in New York now. When Mr. Reardon calls, tell him, please, that I'll be in my office."
"Yes, Miss Taggart."
She hung up, but her hand remained on the receiver, clinging to her first contact with a matter that had importance. She looked at her apartment and at the city in the window, feeling reluctant to sink again into the dead fog of the meaningless. She raised the receiver and called Los Gatos.
"El Dorado Hotel,"
said a woman's drowsily resentful voice. "Would you take a message for Mr. Henry Reardon? Ask him when he comes in to..."
"Just a minute, please,"
drawled the voice in the impatient tone that resents any effort as an imposition. She heard the clicking of switches, some buzzing, some breaks of silence, and then a man's clear, firm voice answering, "Hello?" It was Hank Reardon. She stared at the receiver, as at the muzzle of a gun, feeling trapped, unable to breathe. "Hello?" he repeated.
"Hank, is that you?"
She heard a low sound, more a sigh than a gasp, and then the long, empty crackling of the wire.
"Hank!"
There was no answer.
"Hank!"
she screamed in terror. She thought she heard the effort of a breath. Then she heard a whisper, which was not a question, but a statement, saying everything. "Dagny."
"Hank, I'm sorry." "Oh, darling, I'm sorry, didn't you know?"
"Where are you, Dagny?"
"Are you all right?"
"Of course."
"Didn't you know that I was back and alive?"
"No, I didn't know it."
"Oh, God, I'm sorry. I called. I..."
"What are you talking about? Dagny, where are you?"
"In New York. Didn't you hear about it on the radio?"
"No, I've just come in."
"Didn't they give you a message to call Miss Ives?"
"No."
"Are you all right?"
"Now?" She heard his soft, low chuckle. She was hearing the sound of unreleased laughter, the sound of youth growing in his voice with every word. "When did you come back?"
"This morning."
Dagny, where were you?
She did not answer at once. My plane crashed, she said, in the Rockies. I was picked up by some people who helped me, but I could not send word to anyone.
The laughter went out of his voice. As bad as that?
Oh, the crash? No, it wasn't bad. I wasn't hurt, not seriously.
Then why couldn't you send word?
There were no means of communication.
Why did it take you so long to get back?
I can't answer that now.
Dagny, were you in danger?
The half-smiling, half-bitter tone of her voice was almost regret as she answered, No.
Were you held prisoner?
No, not really.